Hello, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with news from the Arizona Daily Sun for Thursday, March 27th. I'm Flagstaff volunteer reader Joe Ganey, and our front page headline articles today include Calling Out Crane, Cuts Put Native Youth Program in Danger, Sunnyside Drive-By Shooter Handed 10-Year Sentence, and Flag Home Prices Lower in February. And here we go with those front page headline stories, beginning with one written by SunStaff reporter Sam McLaughlin. This is, Where's Eli? Flagstaff citizens call out Congressman Crane for lack of engagement with community. Flagstaff residents turned out to demand more accountability from their congressional representative, Eli Crane, on Monday. Not for the first time this year, and certainly not for the last time, hundreds of protesters lined the sidewalk and lawn in front of Flagstaff City Hall. They criticized Crane, who serves Arizona's 2nd Congressional District, for his lack of engagement with the city and for his support of President Donald Trump's aggressive cuts to federal agencies. Initially, a smaller group of around 75 people gathered outside the downtown Flagstaff Library at 12:30 p.m., where members of Crane's staff were scheduled to offer appointment-only office hours from 1 to 3 p.m. In a notice ahead of the rally, organizers said Crane has never hosted a town hall or open meeting in Flagstaff. "We are the people he was elected to represent, and we demand that he listen to our concerns," they wrote. At the library, some protesters chanted, "Shame on Crane." One attendee, Alan Motter, said he didn't believe Crane was providing effective representation for Arizonans. "I don't think he represents Arizona," Motter said. "I think he represents Trump's agenda really well. I don't think he represents Arizona's agenda, blue or red." Another attendee, Marie Sansone, was angered by Crane's support for the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, which has spearheaded firings and budget cuts across a swath of federal departments and agencies under the direction of Elon Musk. She noted that after Crane attempted to impeach a federal judge who had challenged some DOG actions, Musk donated $6,600, the legal maximum, to Crane's campaign fund. "Mr. Crane does not even live in our district. He has not made an effort ever to come to Flagstaff and talk to his constituents here," Sansone said. "We need somebody that is out meeting with people and understanding what their issues are." Crane is the representative for Arizona's 2nd District, but resides in Oro Valley outside Tucson, which is part of Arizona's 6th Congressional District. He first won election to the U.S. House in 2022, and he later defeated former Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez to win re-election in 2024. He has been a stalwart Trump supporter throughout his time in office. Since his first victory, Crane has visited Flagstaff at least a handful of times, meeting with Northern Arizona University's president, the Flagstaff Republican Women, and the Flagstaff Chamber of Commerce. He spoke at the opening of a local Trump campaign field office in September 2024. "He needs to come and display the courage that he campaigned on since he was a Navy SEAL," Paul Lenz said, referencing Crane's 13-year military service. "But he's afraid to come and talk to his constituents in Flagstaff, even though he's somebody who said he was going to reach out to all members of the district." Lenz, like many protesters, said Crane should hold a town hall during which members of the public can interact with him directly and express their concerns. The day's rallies were coordinated by a coalition of local organizations, including the Catch Fire Movement, the Women's March Flagstaff, the Arizona Students Association, Indivisible Northern Arizona, and the Coconino County Democratic Party. Catch Fire co-founder Eva Patsova, said her group had attempted to deliver a memo to Crane's staff, carried by someone who had an appointment, petitioning Crane to hold a town hall in Flagstaff. She wasn't sure if the congressman's staff would actually read or deliver the memo, she noted. The number of protesters swelled as the rally moved to Route 66 in front of City Hall at 2:30 p.m. Underneath the flagpoles behind the building, someone had propped a cardboard cutout of Crane, decorated with a sign that read, "Where's Eli?" and a mock missing person flyer. Among the crowd, other signs read, "Where's that Navy SEAL courage?" "Eli Crane AWOL on democracy," and "Where are you?" To veterans in attendance, Crane's failure to stand up for former military service members who lost their federal employment during DOG-directed mass firings was particularly galling. Steve Hall, a veteran of the Vietnam War, carried a sign reading, "Eli Crane is a traitor to Arizona vets." He ran on being a veteran and doing things for veterans, Hall said of Crane. "The only thing I can say is he did supposedly introduce a bill that went nowhere to employ more veterans. And now that they're being fired all over the place, he has done absolutely nothing." On a scale of 1 to 10, U.S. Army veteran Lee King said, "I'd give Crane a minus 2. I know that there's waste in the federal government. I think we all know that," King said. "But to just allow someone like Elon Musk and these young men," referring to the small cadre of engineers picked by Musk to lead DOGE, some as young as 19, "to go into all of these different agencies and either shut them down or fire the employees, it's disgraceful. It's disgraceful. I spent 32 years in the Army. I retired as a sergeant major. This is not what I served my country for, to see this happen." "Not at all," King continued. "I can't even tell you the depths of my despair at the way the country's going right now." Other attendees highlighted Trump's plan to dissolve the Department of Education and the mass terminations of public lands employees, some of which have been temporarily halted or reversed by judicial intervention as issues of particular concern. "I'm a semi-retired teacher, and I'm really upset about the Department of Education," said an attendee named Marie, who did not provide her last name. She was worried, she said, that special education programs and students receiving individualized education plans would be hit hardest by the loss of federal support and oversight. "I'm a special education teacher," said Jared Smith, who recently moved to Flagstaff from Florida, "and the dismantling of the Department of Education, all these things, have been on a certain political party's agenda for a long time. Americans have a long history of voting against their actual interests, and I feel like we're reaping what we sow," Smith added, "but it's important that people see that we don't want this." Another protester, Artek Durham, said Crane has basically become unavailable to his constituents in northern Arizona. Durham said he tried to make an appointment to speak to Crane's staff at the library, but his appointment was canceled. "He's absent. He hasn't listened to any of our concerns," Durham said. "He's not addressing the concerns we have for our district and for our safety with wildfire and public land management." Tony Prothero, too, said she had attempted unsuccessfully to schedule a meeting with Crane's staff. She was told that they were only meeting with constituents who needed help with ongoing casework at federal agencies. "I'm very concerned about the effects of federal cuts on our ability to protect the forests," Prothero said. She's been calling her representatives, but wanted the opportunity to speak to someone in person and felt let down when Crane's staff told her that wasn't an option. "I do reach somebody each time I call. They're always very polite, she added, but it's not the same thing as sitting face to face with somebody. Coconino County Democratic Party Chair Laura Carter said she thought Crane was not fulfilling his oath to uphold and protect the U.S. Constitution. The fact that he continues to not only allow, but support efforts on the part of the current administration to dismantle our Constitution, to strip Americans of their rights, to deport citizens and non-citizens without due process. We have to stand up and not let that happen, Carter said. Brandon Gustafson held a sign emphasizing his own oath to the Constitution. He said he took twice, once as a member of the Peace Corps and once as a public educator. What makes us American is this document. It's our guiding principle, Gustafson said. I think this is an opportunity for the people's voice to be heard, and I think everyone should take advantage of opportunities like this to have your voice heard as an American, he added. Although there were no organized counter-protests or signs of support for Crane at the rally, some passing drivers revved their engines or gave a thumbs down out the window in apparent opposition. And one attendee told Arizona Daily Sun staff that a young man dressed in a suit jacket had given a Nazi salute and said, "Heil Hitler," when she complimented his apparel. The Arizona Daily Sun approached that man for comment. He refused to state his name and said, "If I, expletive, love Hitler, so expletive be it, dude, get expletive lost," before calling the reporter a homophobic slur and continuing to hang around the edges of the protest. Whether this man was the same person who gave a Nazi salute and praised Adolf Hitler during a pro-immigration rally downtown last month is unknown. Warrior up. Attendees gathered by the flagpoles behind City Hall to hear Jonathan Nez speak around 3:45 p.m. Nez, who challenged Crane in the 2024 election, highlighted the recent disappearance of web pages honoring the Navajo Code Talkers from Department of Defense websites. The crowd booed, and Nez said, "That is a disgrace, not only for the Navajo people, but for all of us." Crane, Nez says he's standing up for veterans, but we all know he's complacent. He's not saying a damn thing right now. "Have you seen your congressman?" Nez asked the attendees. "No," they shouted in response. Referencing the long history of indigenous people's contributions to the United States, Nez told the crowd, "It is time for each and every one of us to warrior up. Warrior, warrior up." The Arizona Daily Sun reached out to Crane's communications director on Monday and again on Tuesday to see if the representative or anyone affiliated with his office wished to comment on the protests. At the time of publication, Crane's office had not replied to those inquiries. And that article was, "Where's Eli? Flagstaff citizens call out Congressman Crane for lack of engagement with community." Here's our next headline news article attributed to Daily Sun staff. This is, "Flagstaff home prices lower in February, but 2025 average so far still higher than previous years." Flagstaff home prices in February were lower than at the start of the year, according to Northern Arizona Association of Realtors, or NAAR, data, though the median sales price for the year so far is higher than it was at the same point in 2024. The February 2025 market review from NAAR found that the median sales price of residential homes in Flagstaff was $617,500 that month, with homes sold for $363 per square foot. February's median sales price is 14.8% lower than January's median sales price of $725,000, It's also 2.4% lower than the median sales price in February 2024. The month saw 122 new listings in the Flagstaff area, with 241 in active inventory, which equates to 3.9 months supply. All three metrics are higher than their totals for both January 2025 and February 2024. The average median sales price for the year so far is $681,000, which is 4.8% higher than at the same point in 2024 at $649,500. This continues a trend from the previous year. The median sales price for the first 2 months of 2023 was $597,500, and in 2022 was $619,349. There have been a total of 141 closed sales in Flagstaff this year so far, up 10.2% from 2024's total of 128 across the first 2 months. The Arizona Association of Realtors monthly Arizona Housing Report also found that the statewide median sales price was lower than both this January and the previous February, as it is currently $442,000. The report lists a seller's market for Arizona with 5.28 months of inventory. It notes that 6 months is considered a balanced market. The number of listings, 42,233, across Arizona is higher than both the previous month and year, while the number of sales, 7,138 statewide, is higher than the previous month and lower than the previous year. AAA's, and I think that's Arizona Association of Realtors, report on fuel prices, accessed March 21st, lists that the national average price for regular gas, I guess that's AAA, never mind, AAA's report on fuel prices, accessed March 21st, lists that the national average price for regular gas is $3.129, compared to Arizona's average of $3.343. That average for Arizona is similar to the previous day and week and lower than the average price a month and year ago. Coconino County's average fuel price of $3.205 is lower than statewide, though it is the second highest tag among Arizona counties, behind Maricopa County's average of $3.546. Flagstaff's current reported average for regular gas is similar to the county at $3.204. A year ago, the average price was $3.654. The state's highest recorded average price came on June 17, 2022, according to AAA, when regular unleaded gas cost an average of $5.388. Flagstaff's highest recorded price came 3 days later, with an average cost of $5.162 for regular unleaded gas on June 20, 2022. The NAAR market review can be found at nazrealtor.com/tools, with the monthly report from Arizona Associations of Realtors at aaronline.com/2021/03/24/arizona-housing-report. Information on fuel prices is available at gasprices.aaa.com. And that article was Flagstaff Home Prices Lower in February, but 2025 average so far still higher than previous years. Next up today, we have another article by Daily Sun staff titled Sunnyside Drive-By Shooter Handed 10-Year Sentence. The man who pleaded guilty to an attempted drive-by shooting in Flagstaff's Sunnyside neighborhood received a 10-year sentence in Coconino County Superior Court on Monday. Miguel Oscar Barajas Calderon, 34, was originally charged with commission of a drive-by shooting, three counts of aggravated assault, and prohibited possession of a weapon after he fired a 9mm handgun out the window of his car on March 8, 2024, hitting another man twice in the leg. The victim survived and was transported to Flagstaff Medical Center for care. Barajas Calderon pleaded guilty to a single count of attempting to commit a drive-by shooting on February 10th. In the pre-sentencing memo filed on March 18th, Deputy County Attorney Daniel Noble wrote that video of the incident, captured by the dashboard camera of a tow truck parked nearby, rebutted Barajas Calderon's claim of self-defense. The victim of the shooting, Noble noted, did not display a weapon at any point and was on foot while Barajas Calderon was in a vehicle. This is a situation that defendant could have easily driven away from, Noble stated. There were no representatives of the victim or supporters of Barajas Calderon present at the sentencing hearing on the morning of March 24th. Barajas Calderon's defense attorney, Adam Zickerman, did state that his client's family had been in contact and remained supportive. In a brief statement translated by the court interpreter, Barajas Calderon said he hoped for the opportunity to get back to work and prove that he is not a bad person. Noble, on behalf of the state, requested a sentence no less than the presumptive 7.5 years in prison. As aggravating factors, he cited the physical and emotional harm to the victim, as well as the ambush-like nature of the incident. Senior Commissioner Dan Slayton told Barajas Calderon that he had reviewed the video footage of the incident. "You shot a man, basically at point-blank range. I have to say, Mr. Barajas Calderon, candidly, you're fortunate you're not going to prison for the rest of your life," Slayton said. Slayton sentenced Barajas Calderon to a term of 10 years in Arizona State Prison, with credit for 381 days of pre-sentencing incarceration. The sentence falls in the middle of the range for this offense, 5 to 15 years, and slightly above the presumptive sentence, as the prosecution requested. Barajas Calderon displayed no obvious emotional reaction to the sentence as he exited the courtroom. And that was Sunnyside drive-by shooter handed 10-year sentence. Our final headline news story today was written by Shayla Daverman at Cronkite News. This is Science and Health Program for Native American Youth at NAU in Danger of Shutting Down. Lab coats hung on hooks and cabinets gave way to tall ceilings above typical black-topped science tables. The windows framed Flagstaff's canopy of trees and mountains in the distance. The room was cluttered with expensive scientific equipment, pipettes and an abundance of gloves. Instead of food, the freezer contained cell cultures and isolated DNA samples. It smelled clean and had everything needed for a fully functional lab. Amber Kelly, a lab student worker at Northern Arizona University, or NAU, who is Navajo, was born in Tuba City and raised in Flagstaff. She's always been interested in science, but many careers in STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, math, and medicine, require lab or research experience. So when she saw a flyer offering a paid internship through the Cultural and Academic Research Experience, or CARE, at NAU, she jumped at the chance to get involved. "I think it's mainly cancer that made me push to public health, because most people don't even know that Native Americans are more prone to cancerous diseases," Kelly said. After President Donald Trump issued several executive orders banning diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, care has scaled back significantly and is in danger of shutting down. Kelly studied the health impacts and the legacy of contamination from more than 500 abandoned uranium mines on the Navajo Nation. There's a particular hotspot, like 40 minutes away from Flagstaff, in the small town called Cameron, Kelly said. She has family living near Cameron, one of the places with higher health risks due to radiation exposure and contaminated water, dirt, and livestock. Although CARE worked mainly with Indigenous students hoping to increase the number of Native Americans in STEM, the program welcomed everyone. Trump's directives, calling DEI programs illegal and immoral, have been hitting the Indigenous health communities hard. At least initially, they laid off 800 Indian Health Service employees nationally, impacting all across the country, said Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays during the Rural Health Forum held in Phoenix on February 18th. The National Council of Urban Indian Health issued a press release deeming federal layoffs targeting essential tribal programs catastrophic for Indian country. DEI requires context, said Tempe Chief Diversity Officer Felicia McMillan Humes. You have to understand that this is addressing a greater, longer, pervasive issue. Diversity training began with affirmative action after President John F. Kennedy signed an executive order in 1961 that required federal contractors to create equal employment for all. You have to learn how to create strategies to engage individuals who don't feel safe or comfortable or don't feel like they'll be heard, Humes said. But the first thing we need to do is recognize that we have played a role in that inequity. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 created the base for much of today's non-discriminatory legislation. It made all discrimination on the grounds of race, color, or national origin illegal for any program that received federal funding. I feel like that term is being criminalized because DEIA, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, really includes everyone, said Naomi Lee, who is Seneca and spearheads CARE as the program director. For my program, while we had a majority of Native students, it wasn't strictly Native, you know, we had all racial and ethnic backgrounds and needs. In the summer of 2024, 61% of the students identified as American Indian or Alaska Native, and 57% identified as first-generation college students. CARE also provided a virtual option for out-of-state students. After successful completion, seniors are admitted into the Honors College at NAU with fees waived. According to the program's proposal, CARE received nearly 70 applications last year, accepting approximately 30%. CARE spent around $400,000 annually on training, housing, student stipends, staff, and supplies for roughly two dozen in-person students. The funding also covered trips to a national conference for 8 students annually to present research they completed over the summer. In 2022, Kelly went to her first conference. I was feeling so much anxiety. I was so scared because it was my first time presenting in front of judges and new people, Kelly said. That year, Kelly won an honorable mention and a computer as a prize for her presentation at the American Indian Science and Engineering Society, or AISES, fall conference. The program wove students' professional identities with their cultural heritage. Tribal elders visited to share stories and traditions. Instructors encouraged them to speak their languages, wear traditional clothing, and connect personally. CARE also highlighted Indigenous practices and voices through a book club. The National Institutes of Health, or NIH, which funds almost all medical research in the country, provided roughly one-fifth of CARES funding. Lee was looking to renew the two-year contract with NIH, but on January 22nd, she received an email from the contracts management branch of NIH stating, all DEIA-focused contract actions are to be terminated, effective immediately. The current contract had about $25,000 left on it, and then we were supposed to get another $125,000 in May, Lee said. So it's about $150,000 that was terminated from this executive order. This funding loss immediately barred at least 20 students from entering the program. The NIH spent more than $35 billion in the fiscal year 2023 on almost 50,000 grants nationally, supporting medical schools and research institutions. Of this funding, approximately $26 billion went to cover direct costs for research, such as program staff salaries, travel expenses, materials, and consultants. In early February, the NIH announced a significant reduction of overhead costs to a maximum of 15%, which funds things like facilities and equipment. A total of 113 students have gone through CARE since its founding in 2019. The 2025 program planned to accept 30 in-person and 20 online students and hope to expand the latter to 25. COVID-19 created a need for a virtual program and cost an additional $100,000. Right now, we only have sustainable funding for in-person, said Dr. Jocelyn Lee, CARE co-director, who is Navajo, Laguna, and Acoma Pueblo. All of our online and non-summer activities have been canceled at this time. Kelly completed her third year in the program in 2024. She is pursuing a public health degree with a minor in applied Indigenous studies at NAU. Kelly keeps her hair long, hanging past her lower back. Her ribbon skirt, a rainbow of bright florals, was tied at her waist with a sash belt. Her moccasins and traditional jewelry adorned her. She was ready to attend her final CARE celebration. My parents always taught me that you should never cut your hair because it is cutting off your wisdom, said Kelly. Her wisdom was on display at the end of the program celebration, where instructors, mentors, and students and their extended families gathered for the occasion. One student has 10 people coming, Jocelyn Lee said. We had kids there and elderly folks came. Parents were so thankful that their kids had an opportunity like this. It was just exciting to see them say that. We want them to know that they matter. It was crowded and loud and looked like a science fair, with students standing in front of their posters, waiting to present their final research from the summer. It's heartbreaking, honestly, knowing that future people that I've told to sign up for CARE or the people that already are looking forward to it won't have it anymore, Kelly said. Naomi Lee said she is looking into alternative financing sources, even if that means serving fewer students, which is sad, but at least we're still doing something. If our other non-federal funding agencies don't allow us to change our plans, we have to cancel the program. That was Science and Health Program for Native American Youth at NAU in Danger of Shutting Down. And again, that was our final headline news story, so that wraps up the front page today. And this is a good time to remind you that you're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. And remember, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand. From our website, choose Broadcast Info and Audio, then On Demand. Next up today, we have several local news briefs from the Daily Sun staff. First one here is authorities. Missing family may have been involved in I-40 crash. The Coconino County Sheriff's Office, or CCSO, and the Arizona Department of Public Safety, or AZDPS, released an update on the search for three missing family members last known to be traveling from the Grand Canyon to Las Vegas. A joint press release on Monday stated that investigators have identified one of the vehicles from the multi-vehicle collision near Williams on March 13th as a potential match for the family's rented car and have located additional human remains within the debris recovered from the crash scene. No positive identification of remains has yet been made. Ji-Yan Lee, 33, Tae-Hee Kim, 59, and Jung-Hee Kim, 54, all female, were driving west on Interstate 40 in a rented 2024 white BMW with California license plates on March 13th. According to CCSO's original missing persons release, the last received GPS location signal from the family's vehicle came at 3:27 p.m. That information coincides with the time of a major accident near Williams, which completely blocked westbound traffic on the interstate and caused at least two confirmed fatalities. Previously, CCSO said it did not know if the family's vehicle was part of that crash. According to the joint statement released March 24th, however, investigators have identified one of the vehicles from the 22 car pileup on I-40 as a BMW sports utility vehicle. It was not specified if the color or license plates of the vehicle matched the family's rental. The statement detailed that the intensity and prolonged duration of the fire that ensued during the collision makes identification of any remains extraordinarily difficult. CCSO and AZDPS are still attempting to determine whether the remains are those of the South Korean nationals believed to have gone missing in the area at the time of the collision. But investigators are not certain when or if a definitive identification will be possible. We kindly ask for patience and understanding as our teams continue to work with care and precision to bring clarity to this heartbreaking situation, the agency stated. Next brief. Section of University Avenue to remain closed through April 7th. University Avenue, between Milton Road and Yale Street, will remain closed through April 7th, the City of Flagstaff announced. Through traffic along Milton will not be affected, and access to surrounding businesses will remain available via other streets. The affected section of University Avenue, soon to be renamed Fresquez Avenue after the prior owners of the land parcel acquired by the city to enable the Beulah Boulevard University Avenue realignment project, has been closed since February 19th. The extension of the closure was caused by the snowstorms that swept Flagstaff in the first 2 weeks of March, according to the city. The city's press release says project contractor Eagle Mountain Construction is working to finish concrete laying and road reconstruction, and that the entire Beulah/University project is on track to finish this summer. The Beulah/University project includes the extension of existing Beulah northward to a four-way roundabout at the intersection with University, creating an alternate route to relieve traffic congestion on Milton Road. The project also includes a pedestrian underpass at the Milton intersection and subsurface infrastructural improvements. It is part of a 2014 public-private partnership agreement between the City of Flagstaff, the Arizona Department of Transportation, and Phoenix-based developer Vintage Partners, a partnership that also produced the Harkins Theater building on the east side moved the motor vehicle division to its current site off of Woodlands Village Boulevard and birthed the plan for the recently revived Milltown development. Additional information about the project is available at BeulahUniversityProject.com or through the project hotline at 928-255-5153. And the next news brief here is titled Flagstaff's Innovate Green Challenge Open to Applications. Do you have an innovative idea to promote environmental sustainability in Flagstaff? If so, the city wants to hear from you in the Innovate Green Challenge, a partnership between the Sustainability and Economic Development Departments. Now in its fifth year, the Innovate Green Challenge, formerly called the Innovate Waste Challenge, is open to applications from Flagstaff residents and businesses interested in creative climate action. The application period is open through April 7th, to be followed by a pitch competition on April 11th and April 12th. Participants can win up to $30,000 in cash awards. In a press release, Vice Mayor Miranda Sweet said, "Flagstaff's entrepreneurs are some of our best problem solvers. I'm thrilled that this competition will connect Flagstaff entrepreneurs and their creative products and ideas with funding to jumpstart their local businesses." Sweet will be one of the challenge judges. Applicants must propose a unique and innovative startup idea, product, or service related to at least one of the following categories: building electrification / energy efficiency, carbon dioxide removal, clean electricity, community resilience, decreased dependence on cars, electric mobility, equitable systems, waste prevention and reduction, or water conservation. A pre-event pitch workshop will be at the Moonshot Incubator's Flagstaff campus, 2225 North Gemini Drive, on March 27th from 1 to 3 p.m. Last year's awardees in the challenge included Fireflight, a company using drones and spatial data analysis to facilitate wildfire risk assessment, Snuffed Wildfire Technology, which proposes launching a network of small, low Earth orbit satellites to improve wildfire detection, and FLOE smart fans, whose fans linked to temperature sensors will be installed in Habitat for Humanity homes in the Timber Sky development. To learn more or to apply, visit chooseflagstaff.com/innovate-waste. And that wraps up this set of local news briefs. Here's some regional news from Samantha Rea with Cronkite News. This is titled, "Bills would provide nearly $20 million for communications equipment to help battle Arizona wildfires." Arizona lawmakers are considering two bills that would enhance fire departments' ability to communicate with other agencies during a wildfire and pay for engines and water tenders that can travel over rugged terrain. Sponsored by Senator Kevin Payne, Republican from Peoria, Senate Bill 1297 proposes $6.5 million for Arizona municipal fire departments and fire districts. The grants, administered by the Department of Administration, would pay for a secure incident management system for 3 years. The systems, durable computer tablets that can be used without internet in a disconnected mode and can withstand extreme temperatures, are designed to help fire departments work together to manage emergency responses during wildfires and accidents that involve multiple agencies. The tablets can identify the locations, status, and assignment of resources. The improved systems also would allow sharing of maps, building floor plans, and images. Payne said the grants will help protect firefighters like the Prescott 19 that didn't have communications. If they come from different fire departments or different police departments, they'll still be able to communicate. 19 members of the Granite Mountain Interagency Hotshot Crew, a group in the Prescott Fire Department, were killed in the Yarnell Hill Fire on June 30, 2013. A shift in the weather changed the intensity and direction of the fire, according to the Department of Forestry and Fire Management. The Yarnell Hill Fire Serious Accident Investigation Report concluded that radio communications were challenging throughout the incident because of heavy traffic and improperly programmed radios. As a result, crews had to figure out other ways to inform firefighters of their locations and the movement of the fire. Josh Tope, fire chief of the Pinewood Fire District in Munns Park, said radios are the primary form of communication in the field. Nobody goes without one. However, in wildfires where 1,000 people and multiple agencies could be involved, systems that facilitate communication are crucial to avoiding tragedies. The location and tracking abilities of the proposed systems would allow firefighting crews to see other responder locations in a wildfire, he said. According to data from the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management, there were 2,149 fires from January through mid-December 2024, compared with 1,817 during the same period in 2023. Tiffany Davila, spokesperson for the Forestry Department, told azcentral.com that the 2024 fires resulted in 93,229 more acres burned than in the previous year. The second bill, Senate Bill 1285, proposes $12.5 million from the State General Fund in fiscal year 2026 to the Forestry Department to buy fire engines and tactical water tenders. The bill, sponsored by Senator David Gowan, Republican from Sierra Vista, also would add $250,000 for the Arizona Trail Fund. If approved, the money for fire equipment would be distributed to the state's five district offices. The districts could use the funds to purchase tactical water tenders and Type 3 and Type 6 fire engines. The equipment is meant for off-road firefighting in rural and wildland areas. Water tenders are used to transport water or foam to the fire line. Unlike a typical water tender, a tactical water tender can perform a pump and roll technique, allowing the tender to drive slowly while pumping water. Kim Quintero, communications director for Senate Republicans, said both bills passed in the Senate and are being heard in the House. If passed, they would need Governor Katie Hobbs's signature to become law. The funding allocations will be considered within the entire picture of the state budget, which requires negotiations between lawmakers and the governor, she said in an email. I know this funding is a priority, but it's too early to tell what the final outcome will be. Jason Maynard, a firefighter for the Pinewood Fire District, said the visual aspect the tablets provide would be useful for transporting critically injured patients. He said firefighters often are asked if they have a picture of an accident when transporting patients. When there is no time to snap a picture of the accident scene, another agency or crew could take the picture and share it through the new system. Payne said the response from firefighters to Senate Bill 1297 has been positive. Buckeye Fire Chief Jake Rhodes, president of the Arizona Fire Chiefs Association, said his department is already working on implementing the tablets. We support funding being allowed so that other departments can get on, implement the program, and make it fully functional across the valley, he said. Buckeye Fire Department Assistant Fire Chief Rain Gray said the new technology would expand their capacity and interoperability across agencies. Tope also affirmed the fire community's support for Senate Bill 1297 and said he hopes to see more bills like it. He said funding ebbs and flows. Funding really never seems to go away, which is a good thing, but it would be nice to see more consistency so that these fire departments can plan strategically for the long term, Tope said. Maynard said that as operating costs rise, funding is crucial to keep fire services running. I sometimes feel like the districts in the state have been forgotten, Maynard said. If we don't have adequate staffing to take care of our community, our response is going to be delayed significantly. But where state and federal funds fall short, some communities are picking up the slack. Tope said he is honest with community members in northern Arizona mountain towns about the fire district's budget. The community has taken it upon themselves to raise money for the fire station, grateful for the service they provide, he said. And that article was titled, Bills would provide nearly $20 million for communications equipment to help battle Arizona wildfires. And here's another wildfire-related article. This is from Capital Media Services and is titled, Arizona Bill Protecting Utilities from Wildfire-Related Lawsuits Reworked. A sweeping measure passed by the Arizona House giving utilities like Arizona Public Service and Tucson Electric Power major protections from lawsuits for wildfires sparked by their equipment was stripped of the most contentious provisions in a state Senate committee hearing on Monday, the panel's chairman said. Finance Committee Chairman Senator J.D. Mesnard told Capital Media Services on Friday that the amendment he has crafted will remove provisions sought by the utilities requiring people or companies who sue over wildfire damages to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the utilities were at fault. That's a much higher level of proof than what is normally required in civil lawsuits. Also gone is a prohibition on recovering consequential damages, said Mesnard, Republican from Chandler. Those include situations like lost business income or compensation for renting a car if a person's vehicle is destroyed by a fire and the owner awaits a replacement from the utility at fault. Mesnard said that's only fair. The analogy that resonates with me is I get in an accident and the person's at fault, but my car is totaled and I still need to get to work, he said. Well, I need a rental car to make that happen, and that's a consequential damages thing, Mesnard explained. So, you know, the other side is going to pay for my car or a new car eventually, but in the meantime, I'm kind of stuck. Multiple drafts of the amendment posted late Friday and still subject to change also restore the ability to win punitive damages from a company whose negligence sparks a wildfire. What utilities will still get in the legislation they've been pushing are hefty new protections from lawsuits if they follow new wildfire mitigation plans they will be required to create if House Bill 2201 is enacted. But Mesnard plans some changes there as well, removing a provision giving utilities the lawsuit shield if they only substantially comply with those plans. Also gone will be sections allowing the boards of public utilities like the Salt River Project to approve their own plans. Mesnard said having a public utility approve its own plan that grants it lawsuit protections was problematic. Those companies' plans will instead have to be reviewed by the State Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. That resonated with me, the idea of having your own board approve your plan and that allowing for you to then have immunity or some degree of protection, Mesnard said. That did not make sense to me. I needed there to be some other authority. The Arizona Corporation Commission is charged with reviewing plans from regulated utilities like APS, TEP, and Unisource Energy Services under the House-approved version, although Mesnard said he's considering having all reviews done by the Forestry Department. That substantial compliance provision that Mesnard found troubling could have awarded liability protections for utilities even if they didn't follow parts of their plans, like failing to trim back vegetation along parts of their power lines route. Under the House-passed measure, someone who lost a home still had to prove, by clear and convincing evidence, the utility was at fault, even if they didn't follow their plans to the letter. So it's sort of like if we reach a lower bar, it protects us to a higher bar, and I had a hard time going along with that, he said. The version that reached the Senate had legal issues as well, according to House lawyers who reviewed the proposal. Most notably, they said it likely ran afoul of a provision in the state constitution that bars laws that limit the right of people to sue for compensation. The changes Mesnard is pushing should address those concerns. Mesnard said he met with APS lobbyists and with opponents of the bill, most prominently lobbyists for the insurance industry and trial lawyers, to hammer out changes he would need before agreeing to put the measure on his committee's agenda. Committee chairs can kill legislation by refusing to hear a bill, and Mesnard said he was prepared to do that if his concerns weren't addressed. An APS spokesman said the company, the largest power provider in the state, supports the measure and Mesnard's proposed amendment. An SRP spokeswoman said her company still needs to review the final proposed changes, but appreciated Mesnard's attention and expects to be able to support the bill. TEP spokesman Joe Berrios said his company welcomes the clear guidance it will give utilities for submitting wildfire mitigation plans that include procedures for things like cutting off power during high wind events to avoid triggering a fire, and for cutting back trees and brush near power lines. And that was Arizona Bill Protecting Utilities from Wildfire-Related Lawsuits Reworked. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for news from the Arizona Daily Sun today. For Sun Sounds of Arizona and Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Joe Ganey, wishing you well. Hope you're having a wonderful day and continue to do so in the days to come. Signing off for now, and I will catch you next time, folks. Stay well. Bye.